On our earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda. I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage and heart, changes the world. When David Layman and I showed up at Columbia, fall of 66, a month after Frank O'Hara died, little did we know that we would be the last freshmen to wear these silly baby blue beanies during orientation week. Actually, I'm sure we didn't wear them. That in our time at this school, two semesters would be called on account of revolution, the great student strike of 68, where 700 of the 2,400 Columbia students would be arrested. And that our mutual greatest teacher poet, Kenneth Koch, would lead us both to lives as poets. David is a scholar of the New York School of Kenneth Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, Jimmy Schuyler, and Barbara Guest, and he wrote The Last Avant-Garde, The Making of the New York School of Poets. His own poetry continues the lineage of conversational breeziness, first names, overlaying a deepness of thought, abstract-seeming moments that resolve into a sharp focus of observations and emotions. But his style, or styles, pick up and kick out from there, as seen in The Daily Mirror, a poem a day journal in poetry, and other poetry books, including The Evening Sun and Poems in the Manner of. He's also a scholar of American lyricists and singers of the 20th century. Check out A Fine Romance, Jewish Songwriters, American Songs, and his book on Frank Sinatra, Sinatra's Century, 100 Notes and the Man and His World. He's the supervising editor, of course, of the year's best poetry anthologies and also the unaffiliated year's best website and blog. He led the poetry writing department for many years at the New School and now divides his time between New York City and Ithaca. Bound together in boundlessness, here's the David Layman podcast as assisted by Sam Ohana.
Has defined the darkness of red at dawn, memorized the splash of poppies along deserted railway tracks, and opposed the war in Vietnam months before the students, years before the politicians and press.
Goodness, it's really cats and dogs out there today. Thank you so much for storming through the streets of New York today, David Layman. You were born in New York City.
I was. Were you?
No, I was born in La Follette, Tennessee, although my wiki page says I was born in Kentucky because I really do believe I'm from Kentucky. That's where my roots are. Could I ask you to read your first? This is really your first ever poem. Why do you call this your first ever poem?
It was the first poem I wrote. That's why I call it the first poem.
When and why did you write this? And why? How has it managed to survive all these decades?
It survived because it was published.
Where?
In England in 1968.
Woohoo!
I was a sophomore at Columbia. And I went to England on one of these summer programs. It was called an Oxford Summer Seminar, organized by the University of Massachusetts. And it was the most wonderful thing. You got to go to Oxford and study with Oxford Dons. You took two classes and you learned about, in my case, Renaissance poetry and modern drama, But the real idea was to live in Oxford and spend the time with the others who were in this program, who were all from the University of Massachusetts or the University of Ohio or Wellesley or Mount Holyoke or Smith or Columbia. It was probably the happiest summer of my life, I guess.
Oh my goodness, that's so wonderful.
Yes, it was great. And there was a professor there named John Fuller who was a very good poet. I mean, he is a very good poet.
I've read him, yes.
He's terrific.
Sam is even nodding.
Well, John Fuller is an outstanding poet, the son of Roy Fuller.
Right, who's a fantastic jazz influenced poet, right? We know Roy.
John was a tremendously talented poet and sort of child of Auden. And in fact, he wrote a brilliant book about W.H. Auden. Mm. And he was a very charming young instructor. And he had a series of broadsides that he was publishing at the time, the first of which was devoted to the poems of his dad. But the second was devoted to my poems because we came in touch that summer. And he also published Peter Porter and Tom Gunn and James Fenton and lots of others. He was a professor at Magdalen College, Oxford. A really sweet man. And he included this poem. I must have had a copy. The poem is called Ode, and the entire poem is four lines long. I asked a fat man, "Do you enjoy being fat?" "Yes," he said. "It is the only thing that I enjoy." And that's the entire poem. It's a piece of dialogue, but it does demonstrate, I think, the value of having two people in a poem instead of one. Whenever you can have a second person in a poem, you've improved the poem by 50%. Many poems are claustrophobic because there's so much involved with the author. But if the author is able to have two persons, both of whom are perhaps projections of the self, you've improved the poem because you have a sense of conflict and dialogue.
That's a wonderful analysis, because I think poets, for me, writing a poem assumes the reader, assumes the gift of the poem to the other, and therefore assumes an other. But if it's not clear. I think that's a poetic impulse, but the receiving of that is a different story. And by building the receiver into a poem like this, which is, just four lines. And one of the things I love about it is its off-kilterness. A four-line poem, you can at least be regular with four lines. And that last line can hold it together. But your fourth line here opens it up. It's the longest line. And am I right? Is it the longest line?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the longest line, which is like giving it all away, to me. And I love to hear your analysis, because there's a way in which you dug deep here when I said, give me your first poem, into something that could be labeled as juvenilia. But it does give a whole modus operandi for what you do, continue to do which is to, and what poetry does, which is to give it away, not to have it be a, you know, it's why it's the only thing left in capitalism that doesn't, that can't be bought. You know, there's nothing, who wants to buy the poem? You know, you have to give it away. It's the poetic, it's the gift economy that is going on here. And being fat, too, is such a, you know, it's a Falstaffian, you know, the Falstaffian humor, but it's also, you know, just the grandiosity of it. And why not just relax and, you know, put on your braces and enjoy it, you know?
Well, I think that at the time, I was...
Did you write that? You wrote this at Columbia when you...
No, did you write in
high school?
I was in high school.
I figured. This sounds like that Stuyvesant in the Margins poem.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly. And I think I was in the 11th grade. But I was wondering about weight and... body shape, and because the society puts a great value on being slender, much more now. It used to be that I think that if you were portly in the 19th century, I think that was a sign of prosperity.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's and still in some parts of the world it still is. Be fat so that you can show that you, you know, you can luxuriate in life. You know, you don't have to. You're not starving, which a lot of people are.
Well, in the U.S. Today, we have a movement to tax sugared drinks. For example, in California, they've passed a resolution to tax.
Yep.
Sugar
it's coming.
Drinks.
It's going to be the next social change, you know, although...
Well, it makes sense from the point of view of health.
Yeah.
To discourage people from drinking soft drinks.
Right, empty calories.
Empty calories.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
And I guess I agree with that conviction.
Sure. You know, it's like you agree with no smoking, with no tobacco smoking. You know, the when we were... Did you smoke when you were in college?
Yes, I was a professional smoker.
What did you smoke? What was your brand?
Well, I began with Marlboro Reds, and then I graduated...
In the box, you'd like them?
Either the box or flip top... the thing
soft
about,
pack or
the
soft flip
pack,
top box.
They were longer than the flip top.
Oh, really?
So yes, you have to keep that in mind. But the but then I went to Camel Unfiltered.
Ooh.
Once you reach that plateau of satisfaction and self-destruction, it is hard to turn around.
Well, we didn't know it was self-destruction. Nobody told us, you know?
Oh, no, people told
they
me.
They did? They were
oh,
telling
yes,
us?
Oh, yes, my mother told me, my father told me.
Oh, boy.
My eye doctor told all sorts of people told me. But the only thing that Unfiltered Camels could prepare you for was Unfiltered Gitans.
Uh-oh. Yeah, yeah. All the way.
But they're really exquisite.
Yeah, yeah. You're gonna smoke. Yes, I just, you know, and I worked in bars those years, and my clothing was always suffused with the smoke, and everybody smoked. You know, it was that was, you know, it wasn't that it was cool, although it was cool, but it was just what everybody did, and I think it did give you an appeasement.
The whole process of lighting up and taking the cigarette out, lighting a match or your lighter.
The communal social thing with lighting other people up, you know, and everybody's relaxing together. We're so lucky to be poets, and it's and yet at the same time, of course, it's the, you know, we're the whipping boy of the world. You know, like I don't think things have changed that much from when I couldn't imagine that there was such an occupation. You know, when I took the Cooter preference tests in New Richmond, Ohio, there was no choice of to be a poet when you grew up. You know, the closest I could come was to be a garbage collector, which I misinterpreted. I thought that by garbage collector, it meant that I would go from garbage heap to garbage heap and collect the different items that were collectible and create these collections with them. And I would be a garbage collector. That, of course, was, and that was the job I ended up with.
But is that, what do you mean that's the job you...
Well, that's what I said, that I was, it was either that or some kind of a teacher that I was going to be. I mean, I selected garbage collector as the number one choice of my, you know, for, you know, they said, what do you really want to be? And it didn't dawn on me. I mean, there was no sanitation workers in New Richmond. You know, you took your garbage to the dump. So the idea of being a collector of that seemed pretty, I don't know.
Well,
I need a poem.
You're the first person I've spoken to in quite a while who considered sanitation worker as a career.
Yeah, well.
But they didn't have that as a major at Columbia.
No, but they did require that you pass a swimming test to get your
Oh, you remember that.
I not only remember it, but I remember someplace you say that you don't swim.
You know? Oh, no, I swim.
Oh, you did. That was just that was the persona there that you took on.
Oh, I think in this poem, but which
trying to get
I
us
guess,
there.
I guess I'll read this poem. But no, in fact, I love swimming. But before I read the poem, may I ask, do you recall when we had that swimming exam at Columbia? Did we swim nude?
Yes.
I was thinking I remember it. And it was like 20 laps? Is that what
I just mean? Remember it, one lap or two, but maybe it was 20. I passed it. I do remember that. Luckily.
Well, I think that is lucky. I happen to favor swimming as a form of physical exercise.
Do you swim often?
I do to this
wow.
day. Yeah. The poem is called The Difference Between Pepsi and Coke. Can't swim. Uses credit cards and pills to combat intolerable feelings of inadequacy. Won't admit his dread of boredom. Chief impulse behind numerous marital infidelities. Looks fat in jeans. Mouths cliches with confidence. Breaks mother's plates in fights. Buys when the market is too high and panics during the inevitable descent. Still, Pop can always tell the subtle difference between Pepsi and Coke. Mm-hmm. Has defined the darkness of red at dawn. Memorize the splash of poppies along deserted railway tracks and oppose the war in Vietnam months before the students, years before the politicians and press. Give him a minute with a roadmap and he will solve the mystery of bloodshot eyes. Transport him to mountaintop and watch him calculate the heaviness and height of the local heavens. Needs no prompting to give money to his kids. Speaks French fluently and tourist German. Sings Schubert in the shower. Plays pinball in Paris. Knows the new maid steals and forgives her. That's the poem. I wrote this in June 1977. in Paris at a cafe, having a few drinks, and having read a great deal of Auden, who influenced the writing of this poem. And it's a completely made-up persona, although people assume that it's my father, because this is the line, still Pop can always tell. And Pop is also because Pepsi and Coke are
pops.
Soda
Pop. It's Pop, exactly.
So father here is a made-up figure, and any made-up figure is largely oneself projected.
Well, even our discussion today, you know, the idea of of Vietnam was something that you talked about earlier, how you had the cognizance of it through your teacher, and what happened with Johnson, with the Dominican Republic leading into the Vietnam, you know, you did have that. But what I love about many things about this poem, and Auden, you know, I mean, I see so much of Kenneth in your work, and he was so influential for both of us. For me, he was my gateway drug into poetry. Although I had met Thomas McGrath, the marvelous Minnesota populist poet, on a ship, on a transatlantic student ship, 11 days it took us to cross over, and McGrath held court about poetry every day. So that was a wonderful.
When was that?
That was the summer before we started at Columbia.
66.
Yeah, I got to do that.
So that was kind of accidental.
It's just totally accidental. Yeah, but the thing about this poem is that it rocks back and forth between, you know, great things and terrible things. You know, and nobody wants to be told in a poem that you bring, I think what you're describing here is the person who's reading it often identifies with, this is, you're talking about me, I'm doing this, you know, you just tend to take it on, and sometimes they're great, but sometimes they're fat and their jeans don't fit, and which again, it goes back to the, you know, we've only had two poems so far in this little bitty potty cast.
See, that's the thing. All of my poems are really about weight control.
I was waiting for that.
I know you were, and that was a setup, but it's true. I've been involved in body shape poetry. BSP, we call it. Body shape poetry.
You're so funny. It really is the quintessence of New York school. I just wish we could have hung out with Frank, like Bill Berkson and Frank Lima and David Shapiro did back in those days. That would have been so much fun. You know, although we had plenty, and Kenneth, you know, the thing about Kenneth was that he was funnier than Frank, in my opinion. Funnier than Frank, but he was always so worried that his funniness was keeping him from being taken seriously. That was just so that
you're
was
right.
sad.
You're right.
You know,
that's true to the very end.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing he said to me was, I visited him a month before he died, and he said at the end of the, you know, the visit, he said, when you write the obituary, don't call me Dr. Fun. So he was certain, so he knew he was going to die. He was certain that I would write an obituary. You know, I had written an...
So smart. He was so smart.
I wrote a piece about him. It was published in the American Poetry Review, this of tabloid sized.
The Rolling Stone of poetry.
Yes, the Rolling Stone of poetry. And I called it Dr. Fun because...
you are bad!
No, this is a long time. This was much earlier.
Okay, this was not the obituary. Okay, you're
years
free.
Earlier. He's still alive. And, I called it that because that was Ashbery's nickname for him when they were, you know, as young as we are.
Yeah.
And he hated that. I'm not sure why, but he hated it. And he said to me, when you write the last avant-garde in that book, I will give you permission for reprinting all my poems without charge as long as you promise that the chapter about me will not be called Dr. Fun. Now, the thing is that you've written enough books so you know how difficult it is to obtain legal permission of copyrighted material. And when the owner of that copyrighted material said, it's all yours free, that's quite a gift. Yeah. And it really saves you an incredible amount of time and a lot of anxiety and so on. And there was a condition attached, which I met, but it meant that he hated that phrase. Mm. And I don't see, intrinsically, the idea of calling Kenneth Cope Dr. Fun does not seem to me to be that horrible because it balances his scholarly ability and his ability as a professor and his academic approval and so on with his joy and entertainment and humor. But he hated it, and I think it's because he felt that to the extent that he was interpreted as a, quote, comic poet, end quote, his stature was reduced.
Mm.
And that's a great pity.
Yeah, I think so, too. I just, for, you know, and yet he couldn't keep himself away from it, you know, he had to... you know, write as he wrote, and they were as funny at the end as they were from the top. You know?
I think humor is a great thing in
poetry.
Oh,
and it is in yours, and I use it in mine, and... But, you know, what I have here, you were going to say something about that. What I have here is our collaboration.
Well, we're writing a collaboration, you and I.
Yeah.
Who's that in the... in the red over there.
I want to take a guess or you want me to tell you?
It looks like someone I know, but I'd like you to...
All right, then I will. Although I've had guesses ranging from W.E.B. Du Bois to Colonel Sanders. it is, of course, Walt Whitman. This is the Walt Whitman in Light Brights as created by the artist Steve DeFrank. And for many years, this was at the Bowery Poetry Club downstairs.
You know, I look at that and I think, oh, Walt.
Oh, Walt.
I love you. And that just sprang spontaneously to mind when I looked at that picture and I...
That's exactly the words that Kenneth Koch opened our... poetry class, our survey course in poetry with, I believe, 300 students, maybe it was just 100, where we were introduced to poetry by imitating the great poets. And Whitman was first, and Kenneth walked in, threw his arms around himself and said, "Oh, Walt, I love you." I was completely seduced. My life was changed forever with that. And it happens to be the first line of our collaborative poem, which may or may not be finished, called The Address of Poetry, which I would like to suggest we just go back and forth. The Address of Poetry. "Oh, Walt, I love you," as Kenneth said.
And Alan spotted him in aisle 5 between cheer and Lux.
The correct approach, the scalawag, in beard and tux.
With a laurel crown like a tiara on his head.
And through wit's end, tragedies begin.
Lightly and end in a new address on Crosby Street.
Corner of Housing Works and Musée Secret.
Sing poetry's mystery election, universal write-in.
Yeah, well, you got to sing. What I was trying to get there was GPSing.
Oh.
Like GPS, you know? GPSing.
Oh, so that's your line.
I thought it was your line. No, it's my line. That's my line.
It's got to be your line because I didn't know how to read it.
Oh, that's a great poem. Or maybe it's not finished yet.
No, I'm not. Yeah, right.
It's got a lot. He's got kilometers to go before we watch TV.
Yes, miles to go before we learn how to roll a joint.
This is what you say you're working on these days. It looks like a prose poem to me. You, editor of the great prose poetry anthology, David.
Well, Charles Baudelaire was the great inventor of the prose poem, essentially. There were models of prose poems prior to Baudelaire, but he's the one who christened the genre. Yeah. Petit Poème en Prose.
What?
Is his volume, and also known sometimes as Spleen de Paris.
Yes.
That's right.
You know, it's what a what an idea that the tiny organs are in themselves poems, and of course also only Baudelaire could think of using those tiny organs as really, you know, poetic metaphor. You know, just where the crucial inner workings are going on, spitting it out. Hey, do you need another drink?
Well, I could try, but I have to tell you, this is...
You like the talisman?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, and
it's not as sparkly as the...
No, it's very good. It's 92 proof.
Oh, you're such a mechanic of the soul.
Well, the thing is that... One doesn't want to embarrass oneself by drinking too much without acknowledging the stimulus. You have to acknowledge this. Now, how did you know I'd written this poem in the manner of Charles Baudelaire? But you're right, I did. This is my poem. You didn't write this. I would have no ethical problems in reading a poem that you wrote and saying that I wrote it.
I feel no ownership of my work. Except as Ted, you know what Ted Berrigan once said? I hate to quote that guy again, but here it comes. He said, poets of the future, remember, you didn't write these poems. I did.
You really like Ted.
I did like Ted. Yeah, he was my guy down here. Yeah. And Ron. I love Ron. Boy, the first time I was in the room with just the two of them, I was, you know, it was an "Oh, Walt, I love you" moment.
I think Ted was really quite a generous man and great.
His sonnets are one of the great introductions that you can use for modern poetry.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And
especially when they're 13 lines.
Well, that book, The Sonnets, yes, by Ted Berrigan, that's one of the great books. Yeah. And in fact, I remember buying it while we were in Kenneth Koch's class. Mm. I still have that edition.
Oh, of it. God, somebody stole my, with the little dots on it, right?
Is yes.
That, yes. Oh, I love that edition.
Yeah. Poor Ted, he died in 1984, was it?
I believe so.
Was so he was only 50, maybe?
Oh, gosh, something like that, you know, if that. You know, he was born in 40, so I don't think he was 50. And he died days before Edwin died, Edwin Denby. And so that, I think it might even have been 82, not 80, but I'd have to check. That's terrible. But,
It's a great book, the sonnets.
Oh,
it's a really great book.
You know, it has everything is in there. You know, theft, the mundane, the utterly romantic, the absurd, the humor.
The and Rambeau's drunken boat.
Yeah, and the also. The formal layers in it, the way that lines come back, his use of the personism techniques of the New York School, you know, just take straight out of O'Hara, Dear Sandy, you know, and
or Dear Chris, it is 1:10 p.m. Hello. No, that is a great book.
It's the moment, isn't it? It's always the moment. And to be so offhand at it, which is, you know, one of the great gifts of the New York School, balanced against the Beats, who were, you know, never offhand, who were always, you know, as gigantic as possible about it. And one of the great learning experiences, and that Frank Lima helped me to see, was that while I was coming up, it was the Beats who spawned the hippies, who seemed to be the absolutely open and enveloping aesthetic, actually turned out to be quite definitive on who was in and who was out, while the more aesthete New York School, which would seem to be so Frenchified and so narrow-minded and arts elitist, you know, actually had the bigger parties and invited everybody in, and you know, it was a wonderful, wonderful interplay and exchange that was going on in those days. We were very lucky to be coming up in that sort of wake.
I think you're right.
Now, well, you wrote the fucking book, so you should know.
Well, I'm going to read Poem in the Manner of Charles Baudelaire, because it's from the new book that's about to be published, which is called Poems in the Manner of. So every poem is in the manner of a poet, or in some cases, a decade or a style. It's an idea for a whole book. I spent 14 years writing it. And I tried to capture how Baudelaire would write a prose poem in this poem. The task of painting and installing a door is a charming respite for a soul fatigued from the struggles of life. The quality of the wood, the choice of the color, the need for precise measurements, all these things absorb him. And then there are the spectral presences that have followed him noiselessly throughout the day and attend him even now, and with whom he holds lively if silent discourse, while affixing the door with its hinges to the portal. The woman for whom he has built this door has opened a bottle of red wine and transferred its contents to a shapely flask. The perfume enters the air, where it takes the form of quarter notes. There are flowers in a vase on the piano. All this the carpenter sees, and by the time he has installed the door, sweaty and in need of a shower, he sees that the woman has shed her outer garments and is staring at him with a look alternately frank and coy, and his penis springs to an erection like the salute of a well-trained soldier, and his soul enjoys that mysterious and aristocratic pleasure reserved for the man of action who wins a decoration for steadfastness of purpose and steadiness of aim. So I
bravo.
Now my experience as a carpenter entered that poem because I don't know if you know this, but I worked as a carpenter.
I didn't know that.
Well, for a couple of years, I earned some money by doing carpentry work. It didn't pay very well, but it honed my skills so I could make bookshelves of my own.
Wow.
And one time I was asked to build a door, which is not as easy as you may think.
Building a door, I do not think building a door is easy. Sorry, I know enough to know that it's not easy to get a door to hang, to get the jam, to get it to swing, to get it to fit, you know?
And you need hinges. You have to make really exact measurements and on top of all the usual things in carpentry, and you have to smooth the edges. And also, if you louse it up, you lose an incredible amount of time, and you're not being paid that much to begin with. So the thing was that what was very surprising was in finishing the door, that the person for whom I was finishing it was so grateful, I think, I would have to put it.
You did open the door. Or as they say, shut the door.
Well, it...
Sorry. I think of why I'm not a painter too, because this you begin with that dichotomy with the painter and the carpenter, and then the carpenter takes over, and yet what happens is a painting is created, especially when you reach the obelisk at the end of the road, through the doorway there at the end. So a really, and Frank even gets a mention.
It really taught me something, because I mean, it's hard work, and but I'm glad I don't do any carpentry anymore.
Well, David, I think that you crafted that doorway there exactly as a carpenter would, and gave it to us in your poetry.
Well, I got rewarded, and in a most surprising fashion.
Yeah. Well, so did we as your listeners, or readers, as the case may be.
I think the idea is to figure out what the most interesting metaphor or simile you can come up with for an erection.
Like penis. I was going to say, if you did, you didn't, because the snapping to attention like a soldier is kind of like, you know, the high irony of New York school, I think.
Well, I felt that this was accurate.
Right!
Like the salute of a well-trained soldier. There was a certain, that the penis erect is saluting as if in obedience to a great ideal. The charm.
Oh, wow.
Of the naked female body presented voluntarily without any coercion.
Well,
strictly as a reward. So this is a completely anti-capitalist poem. This is a completely free exchange of abilities or...
And that is the poetic economy, after all. Although there is a way in which I see a lot more John Donne in this poem, or at least in the influence of Donne in it, you know, that it does, you know, raise high the roof beams with a kind of metaphorical tent.
Well, that's a very interesting commentary. It blends John Donne and J.D. Salinger.
I'm working on that. Well, I think that we've reached the thrilling conclusion of our podcast here. We've done all three poems, and I just want to thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank you.
Well, that's the podcast. Leading up to it, David Lehman and I did some correspondence, which for us means collaboration. We put together a couple of poems, and after we realized that the podcast was, quote, over, end quote, what could we do but read the collaboration? And now here's a bonus track for you. Two poems, David Lehman and Bob Holman.
Well, I believe that writing this poem, we alternated stanzas. I believe I wrote stanzas 1, 3, and 5, and you have written 2 and 4, and you were obliged to come up with stanza 6.
Did love your ending at 5, but let's see.
Perhaps it ends.
Perhaps it ends. It is possible. But let's.
Well, let our listeners determine. Yes. When Bob and David talk, do they merge into interchangeable I and you? Yes, they do, and after a while, not even the two principals know who is talking, whom is listening, who is listening. It should be who is listening. And whether enthusiasm is as a virtue is even greater than generosity, and does it matter, I ask you?
My lad, enthusiasm grows its own accordion. Responded one to self, verse, vice, poesies, scion. Generosity's in the changing room, a new idea to try on while change continueth. That we shall keep our eye on.
You can say that again. Okay, I will. You can say that again. Keep pouring. I don't trust a man who says, when. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought the amen corner bursts into praise, then mezzo women and baritone men
sing for their supper, and having sung, eat it too. Broccoli Robbie, Tangelo, Porchetta, a bignero stew, a side of collards, a tide of framboise vous, and a point to make point out the rude ragout.
Generous portions, and at the bar, a generous pour. Artie Shaw playing Frenzy via satellite. More good conversation as usually follows from our practice of switching pronouns, his to their, mine to our.
I'm Bob Holman, and thank you for listening to Poetry is Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes. Check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. The podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Rocha with Retiplex. Artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. This podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, the Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Poetry, it goes in one ear and stays there.